Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. This week, we asked the Education Secretary, Michael Gove, why his education reforms seem to make so many people so angry. Teachers, parents, even his colleagues in government. Mr. Gove shares his frustrations with the Lib Dem leader, or Good Nick, Wicked Nick, as he calls him. Here's the story of the most controversial government department from the man who runs it. Think of all the controversial things the coalition is doing. Cutting welfare, lowering the highest rate of tax, reforming the NHS. Yet the issue that seems to generate the most heat is education. Now, to those who know him, Michael Gove is a mild-mannered intellectual who only wants children to go to a state school that can compete with Eton. But to many on the left, he is an, quote, ideological zealot and a hatchet man. Even David Laws, the schools minister, has accused him of politicising Ofsted, the education inspectorate. So what really motivates Michael Gove? Well, I'm in a very good position to ask that question because I happen to have him in the studio. Mr. Gove, why do you think your reforms are so controversial?
I think when you've had a group of people who've been responsible for shaping and framing education policy for generations, and then you have a challenge to their authority, then you're bound to have a very powerful pushback. I think that in education we've had for a generation, essentially since the 1960s, people who've been occupying the commanding heights of the educational debate, who've run teacher training colleges, who've had a grip on the teaching unions, who've been running various bureaucracies which have been responsible for supporting what schools do, and they've inhabited a thought world. They've had an approach towards education which has been out of kilter, actually, with what a majority of parents want, and certainly what a majority of parents who can choose with their own money to secure the sort of education they want for their children, it's certainly been out of kilter with them. And I think that having that view challenged inevitably creates a reaction.
Is this what you call the blob?
It's been characterised as the blob originally by William Bennett, who faced a similar fight in America when he was Reagan's education secretary. Blob is an acronym for bloated bureaucracy. And of course, as phrases go, it has a certain political pungency, which is why even those of us who've used it in a throwaway term have found that it's come back to be used as a catch-all description for people who are critical of what we're doing. Of course, the scope, the scale of change that's going on in the education system at the moment means that there are some people who are opposing it because they're ideologically opposed. There are others who are opposing it because they see their particular interests threatened. So blob doesn't cover everyone who's right. A critic of what we're doing, but it's a handy catch-all phrase.
And do you think that culture, that establishment is what is directly responsible for us sliding down the international ratings? Is that what you're saying?
I think there are a number of factors that have meant that our education system has been falling behind other countries. But one of them has been an approach which hasn't valued knowledge,
right.
Hasn't believed that an academic education should be extended to all children, hasn't believed that we should have rigor in our examinations, hasn't believed that academic competition and excellence are worth pursuing.
Why did they dump those things? Why did, in your opinion, why did that change happen in the 50s and 60s? I mean, why would intelligent people willingly choose to drop excellence in favor of egalitarianism?
I think that there's always been a tendency in the education debate for some people who have a sense of guilt, actually, about the privileges that they've enjoyed, who believe that the way to reshape the education system is to reject the sort of advantages that they themselves benefited from. So you will often have people who will be the beneficiaries of a great traditional liberal education who will somehow think that it was oppressive and over-rigid and constricting, and who will want to have an education system which is the opposite of that which they themselves went through. Why that particular view has taken hold, again, it's beyond my skills to be able to discern exactly where all the intellectual roots of that worldview are. But the people I think who've best characterized that worldview, funnily enough, are authors in America, like E.D. Hirsch and Daniel Willingham, and authors here who have done battle with these ideologues in the past, including, of course, chief inspectors like Chris Woodhead and indeed the current chief inspector, Michael Wilshaw.
And do you think, let me find the right way to put this, do you think this matters to people?
I think what happens in our schools matters hugely to parents and matters to our economic future.
But the debate that you're talking on a level here,
yes,
which I think is intellectual and I think has value to it, but which I think a lot of people who just simply care about their kid getting through GCSEs or A-levels are not particularly troubled by.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that it's the case that, and I'm going to misquote Keynes here, practical men who think themselves free of all influences are actually the slaves of some defunct economist.
Right.
In the same way, policymakers, politicians, everyone involved in the delivery of a public service may think that we are pragmatists, but in fact, lying behind different approaches towards education are different views of the world.
Right.
And if you don't understand the ideological sort of worldview of people who exercise influence over things like our education system, then you can go awry. But you're right. On a day-to-day basis, what matters practically is that children are brought up in a home and in a school which is a disciplined and ordered environment. And parents in particular want to make sure that their children, as well as being safe at school and in an orderly environment where they can learn, acquire the sorts of qualifications that will enable them to become economically successful and independent and happy in the future. But it's easy to say we want to have schools where behavior is good and where ambitions are high. You have to take a step back and ask yourself, why isn't that the case at the moment? What are the assumptions that have been made by people who've been shaping policy in the past that have prevented what seem to be very common sense principles being enacted?
See, I'm trying to get to this point about why it is that this department's proving to be so controversial. And I wonder if part of the answer is what I infer from what you're saying is that everything is political, that you see everything in ideological terms. Does that mean that everything ends up becoming a fight? Everything ends up becoming a battle much bigger than it might initially seem to be?
I think it's a very, very good challenge. I think that in politics or in any organization, inertia is a powerful force. And if things are faltering, failing, weak, underperforming, getting organizations to change means tackling the forces that support that inertia. And that will sometimes involve the odd scrap. But I don't deliberately seek out conflict. I try as much as possible to ensure that we can proceed as consensually as possible, because I believe that the type of schools that I'd like to see more and more established across the country are the types of schools that the overwhelming majority of parents in this country would like to see for their children. So in that sense,
yeah,
I'm not going to I'm not willingly engaging in conflict with the majority of parents or indeed the majority of teachers. What I am doing is tackling some of the obstacles that get in the way of those parents and of those teachers building the sort of education system they want.
And you're probably not finding yourself in conflict with the aspirations of most parents, but it is undeniable you are coming up against it with the teachers.
Some teachers.
Well, there was a poll in 2010 which found the Tories 1 point ahead among teachers, and now there's a new poll which claims that the Tories are behind something like 41%. If you're going to achieve all these things, you have to bring teachers with you.
Yes.
And that's something some people would say you're not succeeding in doing.
It's certainly the case that the representatives of the teaching unions have been at times very critical of what we've argued for. But the teaching workforce is changing. And I've found that in particular, teachers in the best schools, teachers in the toughest environments are increasingly supportive of what we're doing in policy terms. And surprisingly, many of the people who are most enthusiastic about what we're doing are not traditional Tory voters.
Right.
If you look on the blogosphere and look at someone like Andrew Old, or if you consider the work of someone like John Blake, they are out and proud Labour Party activists who still believe that the emphasis that we're placing on better behaviour, strong discipline, a knowledge-based curriculum, rigour in traditional subjects. These are things that they believe in. And I think it's striking, actually, that there will often be people on the what you might call traditional wing of the Labour Party, who are supportive of what we're doing, because they recognise how in the past the ambitions of working class parents for their children have often suffered from, middle class liberal condescension.
Someone else you have to work with to get things done, especially in the last few months, of course, is the Lib Dems. And there's now a lot of talk about the disagreement with David Laws. Is that overblown? If it's not overblown, is it political? Do you think the Lib Dems are finding areas of policy to disagree with you with because they want to get the votes of those teachers who are upset?
On a personal level, reports of disagreements between myself and David, I think, are overblown. We come from different parties, but we agree about a remarkable number of things, particularly in the field of public service reform, particularly in the field of education. Of course, there will be differences of emphasis, and of course it's going to be the case that the closer we get to the election, the more people will want to emphasise those differences of emphasis. I think, understandably, this is not a criticism, just an observation. The media will want to emphasise those differences because it adds to the soap opera quality and the dramatic fun of politics. And I think there will be some people in the Liberal Democrats, not David, but some, who will want to emphasise those differences in order to appeal to a section of the electorate that voted for Lib Dems in the past but don't approve of the changes that we're making to the education system now.
Well, he's one of those people, Nick Clegg, because he's talked about problems being sent up to his office from yours.
I don't know about Nick Clegg's view on that particular question, because I think that, again, Nick Clegg obviously has a duty of stewardship towards the Lib Dems. He's got to try and make sure he garners as many votes as possible for them, and he can't be immune to some of these tactical considerations. On the other hand, he's been broadly enthusiastic about the main thrust of our reforms. Backed academies and free schools, backed the more rigorous approach towards the national curriculum, backed our exam changes after one or two initial misunderstandings. So it's difficult for me to know precisely what the principal motivation is. Good Nick, the angel on one shoulder, is saying what Gove is doing is socially progressive, socially mobile, and in tune with good old Gladstonian principles. Wicked Nick, on his other shoulder, is saying, yes, but some of your radical activists dislike it, so pander to them. Ultimately, I can't make those decisions for him. He will have to decide whether it's the good or the bad Nick that he indulges.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the good and the bad, Michael Gove. And let's talk about your personal philosophy and how it's reflected in your education reforms. Mm. I'm particularly interested in the issue of the history syllabus, partly because I taught history, so it's an area I'm familiar with. It's an area I certainly care very passionately about. I seem to get the sense that you have a vision of history, not just in terms of how it should be taught, but actually in what it tells us about ourselves and about our country. Is that fair?
Yes, it is. But I think there's an important distinction to draw here, and it's one I do try to draw between my views as someone who is fascinated by history and has an understanding, which may be, by definition, it is imperfect, of how the past has shaped the Britain that I love, and then my view as Education Secretary. And my view as Education Secretary is that I simply want more students to develop a better and deeper understanding of the past, both this country's and the world's, and then to form their own views about what they consider to be important. And of course, sometimes my own feelings about the importance of the subject and my own feelings about how the past has shaped Britain today can appear to be in tension. But I do try, and I think that the current history curriculum succeeds in creating a framework which allows students to draw their own conclusions about historical themes and arguments.
So it's not the case, and I do, as a historian, I think this is very important, it's not the case that you think that those ideas that you disagree with, that you think are the product of left-wing orthodoxies, should be driven from the syllabus.
Absolutely not. I think it's very important that we have an approach towards history that enables people to understand chronology, that enables people to appreciate how this country and indeed Europe has developed as part of a sort of broader narrative. But I think it's also important that if people want to draw from that the view that all existing history is the story of class struggle, fine. I don't want to use the history curriculum to lead people towards an ideological view. I want to use the history curriculum to inspire them with a love of history and to make them critical thinkers who know how to distinguish good evidence from bad and then argue passionately for their own view about what's important.
If that is the case, and I don't discuss World War One,
yes.
I'm not interested in that, but if that is the case, then why write a piece for the Daily Mail in which you personally attack left-wing historians? I mean, even if yes. your intention is not to put that into a syllabus,
yes.
as an education secretary, can you see why many left-wing historians were panicked by that?
Well, I don't know if anyone was panicked. I can certainly see why some people thought, this is a good scrap and I'll get involved. What was interesting, actually, is that you had some left-wing historians like Richard Evans who went for me, and then other left-wing historians like Professor Gary Sheffield who said, well, I'm slightly embarrassed to be saying this, but I agree with Gove on the First World War. My broader point, actually, which I was trying to make when writing that piece, was there is a dominant view, or there has been a dominant view in popular culture about the First World War, and I hope that in the debates that we have over the next 4 years, more views will emerge, and that revisionist historians like Gary Sheffield and others have shown us that there are different ways of looking at the First World War than those which we've been used to seeing on our screens as a result of programmes like Blackadder, Oh, What a Lovely War, The Monocled Mutineer, and so on. So it was a plea for pluralism. And in that sense, it's been striking that not just Professor Gary Sheffield, but even Jeremy Paxman's latest series on the First World War on the BBC has reflected some of that new scholarship, which allows us to see the First World War through a different lens.
Do you think the current syllabus has discouraged patriotism and good citizenship?
I don't know. I think it's I think it's made it more difficult to get for people to be good historians. But I don't think that it's the purpose of the curriculum per se to instill a particular set of views. But I do think that understanding Britain's past and how our institutions have been formed and how liberty has been a guiding principle, actually, in the minds of British statesmen and women. I think understanding that enables people to appreciate the virtues of our country. But I think it's entirely legitimate, and I think it would be a good thing if we were also to see that some of the things that I cherish in the study of history were to lead people to become the Eric Hobsbawms or the Christopher Hills of the future. I think that my interest in history is reinforced by the fact that historical debates are intrinsically interesting because they engage people's passions as well as dealing in facts.
Politics aside, do you think that history shows there's a unique genius to Britishness?
Well, I think that there are certainly things that are distinctive about the institutions that have developed in Britain and have subsequently been exported, which are worth analysing and worth recognising as special. I also think it's the case that if one looks at British history overall, there tends to be a tradition of wrestling for liberty. And I think that that's a factor which characterises not just the history of England up to 1688, it also reflects the history of the United Kingdom in the 18th, 19th and 20th centuries. And it's also reflected in the relationship between Britain and America in the 18th century as well.
Are you impatient? Are you an impatient man? Is that what's causing a lot of this, do you think? Is it that you see your time as limited in office and you want to get as much done as is humanly possible?
A while back, I met the New Zealand Deputy Prime Minister, and I recognise that as an introduction to an anecdote, that's perhaps not the most exciting or electric thing that anyone can say. But I asked him what single piece of advice he'd give to any other politician. And he said, it's lighter than you think. And I think, while I'm not naturally impatient, it is borne in on me that if you are a politician, it is always later than you think. You only ever have a limited amount of time in office. sooner or later, you'll make some tremendous error and get sacked, or the party which you believe in will be thrown out, or some other outside event will deprive you of office. So in the time that you're given, you should try to do everything that you can. And in that sense, you're a historian, Tim, you'll know that I suppose it's a sort of variant of the sort of view that Protestant Britons would have had in the 17th and 18th century, you know, that you've got to make sure that the span of life that you're allotted in this world is used productively, because there'll be a judgment passed on it. People are passing judgment daily on what politicians do, and there will be a judgment passed on this government at the next election. I've got to make sure that in the span of time that I've got in office, that I contribute to trying to move things in the right direction and make people feel that this government has actually done a decent job.
Finally, I get the feeling from your own personal biography that education made you. I mean, that's a cliche, and most people say that's the case, but I think it's particularly true in your case. Is this a very, very personal crusade?
Absolutely. I do have a powerful sense that the circumstances of my life were shaped by my good fortune educationally. I went to state primary schools where there were particular teachers who encouraged me to read widely and to be more ambitious than my parents might necessarily have imagined I could be. And then once my parents realized that there were teachers in my primary school who believed that I should be pushed, they did everything possible to push me. They made financial sacrifices to make sure that I could go to an independent school. My dad's business subsequently foundered, and I was only able to stay at that independent school because of a scholarship I was then awarded. And the opportunities that I've subsequently enjoyed are a direct result of the teachers that had a profound influence on me. So at critical stages in my life, teachers intervened to give me the opportunities that I've subsequently enjoyed. And I absolutely believe that the good fortune that I enjoyed shouldn't be a matter of accident. The sort of interventions that happen in my life should be par for the course, that we should ensure that every child has the opportunity to have teachers who believe in them and who can make their lives, you know, transform their lives for the better.
Michael Gove, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.